You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to Aryan Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 19th of August 2019, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAryan.com. Well, I'm very pleased to say that I have my co-host here with me today, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, how you doing? It's a glorious afternoon here where I am. What's it like where you are?
I think it's very sunny over large swathes of the country today. It's very sunny where I am as well, and I've been outside doing a bit of DIY, but having a relaxing weekend other than that.
Nothing like being in Britain on a nice sunny day. It's not too hot, is it? It's nice sort of temperate weather, especially in August time. The sort of weather where the invaders pluck up the courage to get in little dinghy boats and try and invade Britain. And I hear that one of them has encountered a bit of a mishap. Is that correct, Max?
Well, there is a story on the Sunday Mail website, or the Mail Online website, which is quite a sad story, really. It involves an Iranian woman who apparently is a psychology graduate doing a psychology PhD now. It doesn't say whether she's finished her studies or anything of that sort, but she apparently decided to abandon her studies in Iran and head for the UK to finish them off. But she was, rather than travelling here in the usual way and buying a ticket and flying over and going through the sort of correct immigration procedure, she decided to climb into a small boat with a load of other migrants and set sail across the English Channel. And as most people will remember, the last couple of days have been pretty windy, and it would have to be very calm weather before I was ever tempted to climb into a small boat to sail across the channel. So she must have been pretty reckless in my view, very sadly. But apparently the boat capsized partway across the channel. A number of people were thrown into the water, including her, and whilst the other people were saved, she apparently lost her life. So it's... I think perhaps migrants will, if they continue to try and get across the channel in boats, particularly as we head into the autumn and the winter, we'll find out that the English Channel is a rather different proposition to the Mediterranean. I mean, the Mediterranean is a non-tidal sea, from what I can recall from my school geography. But the English Channel is obviously it's a tidal sea and can get pretty choppy, particularly during periods of high wind and particularly during the wintertime. So I would say to any migrants that are thinking of trying to make it across to Britain in a small boat that they think again and go and do something else, perhaps put down some roots in France or better still head back to Iran or whatever country they came from and invest their youthful energy and their the skills that our government ministers keep on telling us that all these migrants have, invest the skills that they have in making their own countries better. And that way they'll be able to live out a very happy life in their homeland. And we won't have the tragedy of having to fish dead bodies out of the English Channel.
Oh, it really shows you what a magnet Britain is to these people. They're willing to risk their lives. Now, if they're willing to risk their lives, there must be a glittering prize that they are actually risking their lives for. And that prize is the benefit system and the council houses and the free education and the free healthcare and everything else that we have in Britain that our ancestors scrimped and saved and sacrificed and worked hard for so that they could provide it for their posterity. And that's what's being given away by our governments. That's the cause of it. That's the cause of this death, is that our governments allow these people, once they get here in the boat, to stay here. I mean, we saw this, we've seen this happening with more and more frequency over the last year. There was about 100 in one week, I think. And they were all saying that they're from Iran, because that's the most fashionable place to say that you come from now, because, of course, they all throw their passports away before they get in the boat. And then they say, well, we come from Iran, and because Iran is this pariah state, our British government seemed to welcome them with open arms. Oh, you don't like Iran either? Well, welcome to our country. We'll be happy to have you. There's been freedom of information requests that have been sent in, requesting how many of these invaders that tried to cross the English Channel, how many of them have been sent back, and the government just doesn't answer them. Sajid Javid, I seem to remember when this happened back in February, he said, well, we've got three boats and I'm bringing one of them back here immediately, one of our border patrol boats, to prevent this from happening. And it didn't prevent anything from happening. And this border patrol boat was probably the one that fished the bodies out of the water, or rescued this boat and actually ferried them ashore to Britain. It's an absolute scandal. It will keep happening. There will be more and more bodies that are fished out from the channel, and until they put a stop to it and say, well, no, if you try and break into the country, we're not going to allow you in. It's like trying to break into somebody's house. If somebody's trying to break into somebody else's house, they've got no good intent there, have they? Their intent is to burgle the house. And it's the same analogy as someone who's trying to break into somebody else's country. That there's only one reason why they would be doing that, is because they're trying to sneak in to take something. They're breaking the law. Otherwise, they would go going through the legal route, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I think one of the things that they value is the fact that we have a kind of a liberal society. And so migrants are well aware of the fact that once they join an immigrant community in a liberal society, that it's quite advantageous for them. The people of Hong Kong, however, appear to be adopting an entirely different approach. You know, they don't have the benefits of a liberal society, or increasingly they're being denied the benefits of a liberal society. There they are in China, and now subject to the will of the Chinese government. And they appear to be showing their mettle in fighting for their freedom, rather than all jumping into boats and things and trying to come over to the West, so they can claim the benefits of a Western liberal lifestyle for free. And in reality, you're quite right in terms of, you know, that there is a direct analogy between illegally immigrating into a country and forcing your way into somebody's house. It's just it's the same principle. The people who try to get into Britain illegally are trying to steal the benefits of British citizenship. That's effectively what it is. They don't want to pay the price, which is that they and their compatriots have to work for generations in order to build up the kind of society that our ancestors have created for ourselves. And rather than do that, they want to come to our country and force their way in, thereby stealing the benefits of British citizenship, and they should be treated as people that have broken the law. Anybody that comes to this country illegally should be treated initially as somebody who's broken the law, and they should just be rounded up and put on first aircraft, first boat back to wherever they came from, so that they know that if they want to come to Britain, then they've got to come to Britain through the proper channels.
There has to be a harsh deterrent. That's what it is. There needs to be a harsh deterrent, and it needs to be, you know, point blank. Nobody who tries to break in will be allowed in. They will just be sent back. I don't understand why they don't do that. I mean, to say that she's come from Iran seeking asylum, when she's obviously been through 10, 12 different countries before she even got to France. So it's a false claim in the first place. It's totally illegal what she's done. And she should be either sent back to France or sent back to the first country that she came to, probably Turkey, maybe. That would be the first country I would have thought, because she would have gone Iran, Syria, Turkey, Greece, that route. And the first country that's not at war on that route is Turkey. We're supposed to have this deal with them.
Interestingly, she appears to be a woman who hasn't actually suffered as a result of being a woman in an Islamic country. And so whereas we're led to believe that women in Islamic countries are prevented from undertaking full-time education, certainly higher education. What we find here is that this woman had, by all accounts, the benefits of a university education made available to her in her home country, and not just the basic bachelor's degree, but also the opportunity of studying for a PhD. And so it rather shows the falseness of the claims that are made that women in Islamic countries can't get a proper education, and that's a reason why they might want to come to our country.
Well, maybe she was coming here because she didn't like wearing the niqab or the burqa. They seem to be making a big thing about that over there in Iran, women have to wear headscarves. And yet over here in Britain, just the other day, they were forcing British children to wear headscarves in the schools. They had a hijab day. And just think about the hypocrisy in that. We've got the British government telling the school children over here to wear a hijab and experience what it's like to be a Muslim for a day, while at the same time condemning the Iranian government for making it a law over there that all Muslim women have to wear these headscarves. And then you've got these women like this who are claiming that they're being persecuted, and they're coming over to a country that's doing exactly the same thing, basically. They never think of saying to the Muslims, well, why don't you try not wearing your hijab for a day and experience what the culture's like of being British, where you don't have to hide your hair and you don't have to hide your face out of fear that you're going to be raped by Muslims. Well, that's another news story that went by last week to do with the education system. I believe you've got another one there, Max, to do with education.
Yeah, but before we move on to that, the only photograph accompanying the article about this woman drowning, Mitra Merad, her name was, it shows her without a headscarf, with her hair cut short in a very Western style, wearing a dark top, which appears to be quite low cut at the front. So, again, it would appear that, you know, although we have this impression sort of conveyed to us via our mass media that Iran is a kind of medieval country where women don't have any kind of rights, lo and behold, what we find is that this woman was accorded lots of the kind of rights that Western women take for granted. And so it kind of undermines the reason for us treating her as a refugee, and she was, you know, quite clearly an economic migrant, in my view. But that all the evidence sort of indicates that that's the case. And so it would be interesting to see whether there's any other evidence that comes to light at a later date which shows something different. But I think cases like this tend to show that that generally speaking, that the propaganda that we get fed by our own mass media is just that, propaganda. And a lot of the time, the truth is very, very different. And so I would say that if a woman can dress in a Western style in her own country, because this photograph must have been taken somewhere, either perhaps Iran or some other Muslim country, and unless she immediately, that she got out of the country, had her hair cut and her ears pierced and started to wear jewellery and a low-cut top, then I would suggest that this photograph probably was taken in her home country and shows a very different story from what we're led to believe. But yeah, the second story that's caught my eye in the news today was of a GCSE pupil who, her name was Abigail Ward. She's 16 years of age and lives in Eastbourne, and she was disqualified in her religious studies exam in June, and it was disqualified because she had described in one of her exam answers halal butchery as being absolutely disgusting. And the person obviously that initially marked her exam paper decided that this was Islamophobia. And so because she had expressed Islamophobia in her exam answers, even though it was presumably just one question, that she was disqualified. And her family have since complained about this and have appealed to the authorities. And the authorities have luckily listened to what the family have to say. And the family pointed out that the girl was a strict vegetarian, and that she found the practice of halal butchery to be obscene. She wasn't describing Muslim people as being absolutely disgusting. She was describing halal butchery as that, which is probably fair comment. And but it just goes to show that the person marking her paper initially either was a very zealous Muslim teacher or marker who decided that any expression of that's critical of things that Muslims do amounts to Islamophobia, or it was somebody who is an overzealous liberal who again believes exactly the same thing, that any statement other than one which is flattery concerning Islam is Islamophobia, and in fact it should be possible in this country to criticize any religion. It's certainly possible to criticize Christianity in this country. It just seems that it's certainly possible in this country to criticize paganism because these are religions that are indigenous to the British Isles. But it seems that any other religion, there's a whole band of busybody do-gooders who decide that they need to protect the people who are coming to our country from abroad and they're overzealous in what they do. And so they are effectively damaging the right of free speech, and it should be, and if anybody should have the right of free speech and be accorded a certain amount of leeway in terms of what they state, it should be a 16-year-old pupil writing in a religious knowledge exam, and it just shows really the extent to which our society is now one in which there is coercion and in which the views that we can express are being strictly limited.
Yeah, it's like she's not allowed to have her own opinion. I always thought that was the whole thing about school. When you're studying these things and you get asked to write about them, you're supposed to express your own personal opinion, and you learn how to express that opinion and how to debate and make your point. And here she is being told, well, no, you can't have that opinion. That's a wrong opinion. Can't say that you don't like halal slaughter. I mean, again, this is, this is the way that they get Sharia law implemented in schools, really, where you're not allowed to criticize Islam. You're not allowed to criticize Muhammad. It's just a sneaky way of getting everyone to comply with Sharia law by claiming that it's hate speech and it's motivated somehow by a fear of Islam. I'm glad she, very glad she won that case, but it is very concerning that this is making its way into exams and just what children have to say. I mean, obviously she's a vegan, so she feels very strongly about animals. I dare say she would say that any slaughtering of animals she probably finds repulsive and revolting, but that's a particularly repulsive way that they do it. I mean, at the moment they've got the end of Eid and they're out there slaughtering goats, slaughtering sheep, slaughtering cows in the middle of the street and reveling in the bloodlust. And if it's Islamophobia to say that you don't like that, then that means that everybody else who's not a Muslim is an Islamophobe, because it's just natural to be revulsed by situations like that. Well, we've got some Brexit news here as well. Obviously, we want to talk a little bit about Brexit here. And it was quite entertaining last week where all the Remainers were arguing and fighting amongst one another over who it was that was going to be leading a national unity caretaker government. There was nothing about how they were actually going to get this government voted in, how they were going to get power, but it just seemed to be taken for granted that there was going to be a new government, Boris was going to be deposed, and this wasn't fringe stuff. I mean, this was Ken Clark, he put his name forward, he said he was going to be the leader of the National Unity Caretaker Government. That's this Tory traitor that is more supportive of the EU than of Britain. We had Caroline Lucas from the Green Party, she was going to get together an all-female cabinet with her as Prime Minister, And the Green Party have only got one MP, and that's Caroline Lucas, and yet somehow she thought she was going to somehow get into power with this all-female cabinet, probably through some kind of coup. We had Sturgeon and some of the Labour Party, and Corbyn put his name forward and said he wanted to be Prime Minister of a national unity caretaker government, but then Oliver Letwin from the Conservatives said that he wouldn't really want to be supporting that. We had the Speaker of the House, he weighed in there, said he was working very closely with a cross-party group that were opposed to Boris Johnson's Brexit plans. Luciana Berger, she was in there, she was writing to Boris Johnson demanding that he recall Parliament before the end of the summer so that they could try and force through some new law or whatever. They're getting absolutely desperate. These Remainers are now getting absolutely desperate, trying to think of some way that they can scupper Brexit, which is all written into law. They all signed it into law. The law is that if they don't have a deal by October 31st, they will leave without a deal. And now they're realising that now that there's actually a Prime Minister that does want to leave the EU, he's actually going to stick to the law. And what they are talking about is breaking the law. That is literally what they're talking about, is breaking the law. And they've got the help of The Guardian and the BBC that keeps interviewing them. And, you know, I think Brexiteers are just standing back and laughing at this shambles and this absolute fantasy of theirs of a caretaker government, a national unity government. You know, how are they going to get a caretaker government in? They would have to force it on the people, because they're not talking about having a general election. They're not talking about people voting for a national unity caretaker government. They're just going to have a coup and take power. That's how it seems to me. Anyway, Max, what do you think of all this last week, all these attempts to take over?
I think we're in a situation where we're to some extent in uncharted water as from a constitutional point of view. And so this is why it's very interesting that we've got the Speaker of the House of Commons, Berko, expressing one point of view. We've got the Prime Minister expressing another point of view. We've got the Leader of the Opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, expressing his point of view, and lots of other people, as you say, all joining in. The fact of the matter, though, you know, we are to some extent in uncharted waters from a constitutional point of view. I think that, generally speaking, when that kind of a situation comes about, then the Queen will probably take advice from her regular advisers, but would also take advice primarily from the current Prime Minister. And so I would think that unless there was a very strong challenge that Boris Johnson and his interpretation of the way in which this should play out will probably be the way we go. What we can see, though, amongst all the other groups, though, is that they're fighting amongst themselves like ferrets in a sack, because we've got lots of the Labour people who are anti-Brexit. They're not very happy about Ken Clark becoming the leader of a national unity government. We've got lots of Conservatives not being very happy about Jeremy Corbyn becoming the leader of a national unity government because of the fact that he's regarded as an extreme left-winger. And we've got ex-Labour MPs like Luciana Berger not very happy about the prospect of Jeremy Corbyn becoming the interim Prime Minister because of the fact that she and others have been campaigning to get get Jeremy Corbyn removed on the basis that he's allowed anti-Semitism to run riot in the Labour Party, and so that there are all these other sort of issues that are complicating the situation. And then, you know, I just found it was very amusing that Caroline Lucas put forward the proposal that she did. You know, being somebody who is a very liberal person, being somebody who is the leader of the Green Party, for her to turn around and say that she thinks that women are better at leading in these kind of situations than men is just purely sexist. It couldn't be more sexist if you wanted it to be. It betrays a degree of misandry, which is the opposite of misogyny. Misogyny is a hatred of women, and misandry is a hatred of men. And I think that, and it's fairly evident amongst lots of women politicians on the liberal left that they tend to be motivated by misandry. They tend to be motivated by a dislike of men. And this statement by Caroline Lucas tends to indicate that she's amongst that group of women. And what she and others fail to realize is that if men and women are equal, as they keep saying to us that they are, and I've said this before on Air in Britannia, if, as they say, that men and women are equal, then changing the ratio between men and women in government will make absolutely no difference, because they'll carry on governing the country equally as well or equally as badly. And so, therefore, when people come in and they say, oh, you know, we must campaign to increase the number of women in politics, you have to say to them, well, why do you think women will make better politicians than men? And they always say, well, it's so that the governing body of the country represents in the same kind of proportions the population of the country. Well, that doesn't necessarily have to be so. There is no law that says that there will be an equal number of women interested in politics as there are men interested in politics. You know, irrespective of ability, you've got to look at, you know, whether the equal numbers are interested, because you could have a situation where women are equally as good at governing the country, but by some fluke of circumstance, a disproportionately large number of women just aren't actually interested in politics, because they regard politics as being a kind of an abrasive and confrontational kind of preoccupation. And if that's the case, then there is no reason why there should be the same number of women in politics as there are men, or even the same number of men as there are women. What we should be doing is that we should be looking for individuals who are good leaders and who are good politicians, and we should be judging the people that we select to represent us on the basis of whether they're good at the job and whether they are passionately interested in the job, rather than trying to prop up the proportion of people of one sex or another, or the people of one ethnic group or another. Because, again, you know, the people that turn around and say, oh, we have to have ethnic minority members of parliament to reflect the balance of ethnic minority people in the population as a whole. Well, if those ethnic minority people are exactly the same, if they are equal to the white people that currently hold, or the disproportionately large number of white people that currently hold membership of parliament, then it shouldn't actually make any difference to the quality of leadership if those white people are replaced by black people who are brown people who are equally as good but no better.
It's female supremacy, isn't it? That's what it is. It's female supremacy, it's black supremacy, and there really aren't that many women that want to be politicians. And that, you know, this is the point of it. It's like when they say, well, we need more women scientists. Well, most women don't want to be scientists. And the women that they do get to actually be scientists, they get their jobs because of diversity quotas. There was a physics professor, and he was invited to talk on gender in physics and gender in science. And he collated all the figures together, and he showed that the woman that had been made into this physics head, she only had about 10% of the citations that he himself had. And she was put into this role simply because she was a woman. And when you get to the actual exams that they have in university for the STEM subjects, women are getting an extra 15 minutes to finish the exams in, just so that they can get more of them in there. So they're not actually in there on their qualifications. They're not actually in there because they are superior, as they claim that women would do things in a different way. It's just because they want to be doing what the men are doing. They're not happy doing what women are doing for some reason, and they desperately want to play at being men. And it really is just playing at being men, because they're not getting into these roles through their qualifications, and they're not getting into these roles through merit. So they're not actually having to work as hard as the men do. They just get given these roles, and then they can say, well, I'm the leader of the country, I'm the leader of the science department, I'm the leader of physics, I run the fire brigade, even though women haven't actually got the strength to carry people out of burning buildings. It's absolute nonsense. So, you know, we do need to have a meritocracy. And the really funny thing about Caroline Lucas and this all-female cabinet of hers was her apology the next day. because she wasn't attacked because she didn't have any men in this cabinet. She wasn't attacked for her misandry and her hatred of men. She was attacked because she didn't have any people of colour in it. And she apologised the next day. She was, oh, it's terrible, terrible. How could I leave out coloured people? And you just think, well, and I pointed this out last week, and if she had put coloured people in there, they would have said, well, there's no Muslims, and they would have said, well, there's no homosexuals, and it would have been no lesbians, and it would have been no disabled. And then by the end of that, you would have a whole cabinet that was just made up from people whose only qualification for being in there was their race or their gender or their disability or their sexual proclivity. And none of them at all would actually be qualified for doing the job. And that's what you end up with when you have this equality agenda. You just end up with nobody that's actually qualified to do the job. And on top of that, I mean, this interim government thing, I mean, it's a total fantasy. You would have thought, reading the newspapers last week, you would have thought that there'd been a vote of no confidence, or Boris Johnson had stepped down, and that we had to have an interim government, we had to have a provisional government, and they were arguing about who they were going to put in place. And that hasn't happened. We have a prime minister, we have a government, he has a mandate to leave, he has a law to say that we're going to leave, and they're living in this fantasy world of fantasy cabinet making, of let's pretend who's going to be the prime minister of this interim government. It was hilarious to see. I think Morgoth pointed out on Twitter, he said, well, you know, I've actually lost track of this now. Who's our prime minister again? Because it really did seem like that this had all happened, and it hasn't. There's been no vote of no confidence. Boris Johnson hasn't stepped down. It's, you know, it's business as usual with the government. It's highly entertaining.
Yeah, and it is quite clear that that it is effectively a coup that's being plotted by these people. I noticed in the last couple of days that the main Tory plotters have been shamed into withdrawing their support now. For this kind of thing, there was an article I saw, which I don't know that this was actually something that Jeremy Corbyn actually said, but perhaps that somebody said on his behalf, that what ought to happen is that he ought to become the interim prime minister if there's a vote of no confidence in Boris Johnson, and that he should just go to the Queen and tell her that he's taking over. You know, which you know is pretty much a coup. By any other
I think that's measure. A default position, Max, actually. I think if there is a vote of no confidence in the current prime minister, then the leader of the opposition takes over in an interim government. I'm sure I read that somewhere, that was actually
It's only after 2 weeks that there are 2 weeks in which the existing government can try to overturn the vote of no confidence, or and if they can't in that two-week period, then it's open to other organisations to or other people to go to the Queen and to put forward their claim to be made the next Prime Minister. So I don't think it's something that can be done automatically or straight away, rather. And I think that it's it would be rather presumptuous to just go to the Queen and say, I'm taking over. I mean, whoever thought that was a good thing for Jeremy Corbyn to say, you know, is sort of an idiot of the first order when it comes to diplomacy and winning friends and influencing people.
Yeah, it's trampling over democracy. I guess that's why they're wanting to come back from their summer recess early, so that they can get in this vote of no confidence, and then with the 2 weeks that are up. And of course, that's why Boris Johnson is mulling it over, of actually giving them an extra long summer recess, so that when they come back, if they were to have their vote of no confidence, the two-week deadline wouldn't actually come until after we've left the EU by default, according to the law. And that's just the incredible thing. It's the law that we leave. So anything that they do to try and overturn that is breaking the law, basically. And it can only be a coup that they're talking about, as you say there, Max. Well, you've had had some other terrible, terrible news over the weekend. My heart goes out to poor young Owen Jones, who was out having a birthday knees up at his local pub. I don't know if it was a gay bar or something like that. And he came out of the pub at 2 a.m. and apparently he was beaten up. Now, he claims that he was beaten up by, quote, far-right thugs after leaving the pub on his birthday. Now, there is no evidence that whoever it was far right thugs. There's no allegations of these people actually saying anything at all. And his logic that they must have been far right thugs is because apparently they deliberately targeted him. They deliberately went for him. Now, he is very, very much disliked by a large swathes of the public. I don't think he's just disliked by people that are on the far right, because he's very dishonest in the things that he says. There's reports of him refusing to condemn the violence from Antifa, for instance. And there was actually a tweet from a local girl that I picked up on after this news came out. And obviously, the BBC were all saying how terrible this is. The Guardian was saying how terrible this is. Jeremy Corbyn, all the people on Labour, oh, how dreadful this is. And this tweet from this local girl, she said, "The pub he was in is down the road from me. There is a heavy Muslim gang presence late night, early hours AM. I doubt very much a few far-right activists would be hanging around down on that road waiting to jump on someone from the left. And there are lots of CCTV down that road as well. So we will soon see." So we're waiting to find out what the CCTV says. Of course, he would never say if it was Muslims that jumped him. He would probably say that it was white people anyway, the same as that girl in Germany that got raped by a migrant, claimed that it was a white German guy that raped them. And I also found a tweet from Nick Griffin. And this is from Nick Griffin. He said, "The thing is, young Owen Jones was there at College Green in 2009 with the mob that hurled bottles and darts at me and fellow MEP Andrew Bronze. Hashtag sauce for the goose. Hashtag tough shit." And there you go. What comes around goes around. Owen Jones thinks it's fine to physically attack people on the right. He's been doing that for years. I mean, that's 10 years ago this happened, and he's still supporting it today. And now he's had a taste of his own medicine, I guess you could say. If it was people on the far right, it could very well have been Muslims, as this local girl says. Did you hear about this attack on Owen Jones, Max?
No, I didn't hear about it. I don't think we should assume that Nick Griffin is correct and that Owen Jones has been somebody who's been engaged in inflicting violence on other people. I think that would be a bit presumptuous of us.
Well, there's video of him doing it. There's video of him there with the mob that were hurling the bottles and darts at him with Andrew Bronze. Okay. I've seen the video with video footage of him, because this was brought up a while back when Owen Jones was refusing to condemn Antifa. So I have seen this video, and he is there with the mob. So I guess you could say he's condoning it, even if it wasn't actually him throwing the bottles and darts. So,
okay, but I do agree with you that lots of what Owen Jones writes is very sort of irritating. I can imagine that he does irritate a large number of people. I think really, though, that the biggest lesson from all of this really is that, you know, he's a supporter of the Labour Party. The Labour Party have supported mass immigration into this country. And indeed, Owen Jones has on a number of occasions expressed views that are supportive of the general Labour situation in this respect. And if you import large numbers of ethnic minorities into a country that was previously homogenous from a population perspective, then what you have to expect is that there will be a breakdown of law and order, because that's something that always follows. Now, I've said this before, it's got nothing to do necessarily with the ethnicity or the race of the people that are immigrating into the country, or indeed the race or ethnicity of the people who compose the majority of the people in the country. If you have a situation of immigration into a country, then you always end up with a surge in violent behaviour. And this was why the Wild West was called the Wild West over in the United States of America, when there was there were large numbers of people emigrating to the United States that were primarily coming from Europe. But what they ended up creating was a situation where there was a disproportionately large number of young men of fighting age in the United States. And so therefore, when there were disagreements and there was only a very sort of poorly formed police force in the United States at that time, that very poorly formed police force, which very often consisted of just like a sheriff and a deputy sheriff in a town, were overwhelmed by the violence that occurred. And by the same token, as far as Britain is concerned, we've had this mass immigration to Britain at a time when there's been lots of cutbacks in government expenditure. The numbers of police officers have been reduced quite considerably. And what we've seen from the news footage of immigrants coming into this country is that they are disproportionately young men of fighting age. And so what we have in large parts of our inner cities now is this this disproportion, and these young men find that life isn't as nice or as exciting, doesn't offer as many opportunities as they might have hoped, because there's disproportionately large numbers of them all at the same age, all trying to do the same thing, all competing for limited resources, and it inevitably ends up with a crime wave. And Owen Jones has found himself a victim of the crime wave that the party that he supports has effectively stoked up and created. And that's, you know, irony. That's, you know, what goes around comes around. And Owen Jones just doesn't really have a leg to stand on in terms of complaining about what's happened, in my view.
Yeah, it was only a while back that he was cheering on the people that were throwing milkshakes at Tommy Robinson, throwing milkshakes at Nigel Farage, supporting Richard Spencer, getting thumped over there in America. I mean, he has expressed support for violence against his political opponents, and now violence has been done to him. And as you say, he supports the multicultural experiment, which just increases tension and friction and increases criminal action. So it is hard to have sympathy for him. And the final news story that I've got here, again, it's to do with this tension and this friction that is caused by having all these foreigners here, and it's to do with the knife crime, which, as we know, disproportionately affects black youths. It's disproportionately carried out by black youths. It seems to be something that they engage in. It seems, you know, I would say it's genetic, because it obviously goes on all the time over there in Africa. They have tribal warfare. And when they come over to here in Britain, they have gang warfare. Over there, they use machetes and pangs. And now we have this problem with machetes over here. And in last week's news story, we talked about this police officer who was attacked with a machete, which is an African weapon of choice, basically. And the government are trying to do something about this. Obviously, the way to deal with it is to deport the people that are carrying it out. And if they're not going to deport them, then they need to be stopping and searching them, which they don't want to do because they get accused of being racist. Well, they've now got a two-pronged attack. They have relaxed the laws on stop and search, and of course they've been accused of being racist already for doing this. I don't know quite how they can accuse Priti Patel of being racist. That may be one of the reasons why Boris Johnson actually put her in there, is so that she couldn't be accused of being racist because she's brown-skinned. But the second part of this drive to get rid of knife crime is putting anti-knife crime adverts on fast food chicken boxes, which obviously has a link with, you know, this famed love for fried chicken that Negroes have, which you particularly see over there in America. They're always being linked with Kentucky Fried Chicken, almost as much as they used to be linked with watermelons. So the government is getting a lot of stick for this. They've spent a lot of money putting these adverts on fast food chicken boxes, and there's actually good reason for it. There's good evidence to show that, particularly in these fast food chicken shops, the gangs are hanging around, and they get these young kids and they offer them free food, and then they say, well, if you just keep this bag in your pocket, we'll give you free chips. And if you just hand out one of these little bags to everyone that comes over and gives you a £10 note, we might buy you a Coca-Cola as well. And it starts off like that, and then they get these young lads to become drug runners for them, go out on the county lines, and of course there's all this knife crime that is involved in with it as well. So it's actually evidence based, but of course the usual suspects have been attacking them for it. This is a mainstream news article from the MSN. The Home Office has been accused of peddling racial stereotypes in a crude and offensive plan to cover fried chicken packaging with anti-knife crime slogans. Young people will be warned of the dangers of carrying a knife on specially branded chicken shop boxes as part of the government's hashtag knife free campaign. Following backlash over the campaign, the government said it was an evidence-based project, and Home Secretary Priti Patel said she would not apologise for communicating the tragic consequences of carrying a knife. But her opposition counterpart, Diane Abbott, and fellow Labour MP David Lammy, the usual suspects, dismissed the strategy as a harmful gimmick and called on the government to properly invest in communities to tackle violent crime. Campaigners and members of the public also reacted with anger to the scheme, posting online that it was an example of institutional racism. The chicken boxes are being introduced nationwide following a partnership with Morley's earlier in the year. The packaging will include warnings and real-life positive stories of young people who have chosen activities like boxing or music instead of carrying a knife. More than 300,000 boxes will be distributed in independent and branch-owned chicken shops, including Morley's, Chicken Cottage, and Dixie Chicken. I mean, look at the way they present that there, as if carrying a knife is you know, it's a trade or a profession. Trying to get people involved in things like boxing or music instead of carrying a knife here. It's like they don't understand the reason why these people are carrying knives is because they're liable to be attacked, and they think that this is going to help them to actually defend themselves. And the only reason they have a fear of being attacked is because they live in a multicultural city. And if they get rid of knives, people will just move to other weapons. They'll use clubs. They'll use acid. They'll use bleach. There are all manner of things that people can use to attack people and to defend themselves. I really can't see that this is going to do very much at all. And it's interesting that it's the very people that are going to be most likely to be the victims of this are the ones complaining. The representatives of the black victims, Diane Abbott and David Lammy, are complaining about this. That's the thing that really surprises me, Max. Anyway, what do you think about this?
Well, I would say that placing my tongue very firmly in my cheek, that perhaps one of the reasons why young people that go to these chicken shops carry knives is because there is no cutlery provided for them by the people who own the establishments. You know, one of my bugbears is that these kind of establishments encourage people to go in and eat with their hands, just as people did in the Dark Ages, and just as people have tended to do in the Third World to a greater extent than they have done over here. So it's almost like
That's a good point, Max. That's a good point. I think you may have hit on the reason why these blacks love this chicken so much. I mean, I was trying to work it out, but that's it, isn't it? They get to eat it with their hands. That's got to be the reason.
Well, no, as I was saying, the fact that they have these places where you go in and you're expected to eat with your hands, you're not even provided with a plate or anything like that. You're just given a tray with just the food that you're going to eat in a bag, and you then just like tear your bag open and you see children and people with their food all over their tray, eating it with their fingers. And it's corrosive to our culture. Now, our culture is one that which has been grown up over the centuries of eating with cutlery. And I think that it's perfectly possible to eat fried chicken with a knife and a fork. The fact that knives and forks aren't provided as I say, something which is foreign to us. It's these kind of places have existed in the UK now for several decades, so it may not appear to be that foreign to young people. But I can certainly state that for people of my generation, eating with your hands is not the sort of thing that you want to do when you go out to a restaurant. When you go out to a restaurant, you want to be able to maintain some kind of standards, maintain a degree of cleanliness, not have to have tissues that you wipe your hands and your mouth on sort of because you've got sauce all over your fingers. And you should be provided with somewhere to sit, somewhere that is more civilized and where you can eat in a very civilized way. The fact that these places have then tended to attract disproportionately people from the Third World may be, and I say maybe, because of the fact that some people from the Third World are more used to eating with their fingers in their home cultures and in the countries where that they've come from. So therefore, that's why they feel more at home in this kind of a situation than people from the indigenous community who have been brought up on in a culture where the cutlery is generally de rigueur. But yeah, I mean, putting these adverts in these boxes does rather make the assumption that you think the kind of people are carrying knives go to these kind of establishments disproportionately. And it is in reality an admission on the part of the government that the stereotypes that they would shrink back from talking about and making making clear to the population and to the public as a whole are actually pretty close to the mark in terms of reality. And so if they're going to counter the horrific spate of knife crimes that there are in this country, then really they need to sweep aside political correctness, and they need to sweep aside the things that have made them mealy-mouthed and too careful to state the truth in the past, and actually start to call a spade a spade and call and to state what actually is going on without distorting what they are presenting in order to pander to political correctness.
Well, it does seem like a little step in the right direction in doing that. I mean, as I said, it's evidence-based. As Priti Patel said, this is evidence-based. I mean, it is the sort of people that stab one another that like eating out of a bucket, whether they want to admit that or not. Policing Minister Kit Malthouse said the food containers will bring home to thousands of young people the tragic consequences of carrying a knife. He also said the government was doing everything it can to tackle the senseless violence that is traumatising communities and claiming too many young lives. David Lammy responded on Twitter with, "Is this some kind of joke? Why have you chosen chicken shops? What's next? Knife-free watermelons?" He then went on to accuse the Home Office of using taxpayers' money to sponsor an age-old trope. "This ridiculous stunt is either embarrassingly lazy or at best unfathomably stupid," he said. "I know it might cost a bit more time and effort, but I would love it if you would announce a program of investment in our local communities instead of spending 5 minutes on a harmful gimmick." Diane Abbott also chimed in with, "Instead of investing in a public health approach to violent crime, the Home Office have opted for yet another crude, offensive, and probably expensive campaign. They would do better to invest in our communities, not demonise them." And what they're basically doing there is saying, can't you have just give us that money straight out? Give us more gibs me dats. We don't want you to spend money on adverts. We just want the money. And this idea that if the government was to provide them with youth clubs and ping pong tables and table football, that they would suddenly just stop stabbing one another is cloud cuckoo land. And white people have never had youth clubs and table tennis and ping pong 50 years ago. They used to go out in the streets and kick a football around on the street. And they certainly would never think of stabbing one another. The answer that the ethnic minorities always have is more money. Give us more money. Pay us more money to stop the violence. And this political correctness here, David Lammy would rather see people stabbed than have it admitted that the people that stab one another are more likely to go in chicken shops. That's the truth of it. And Sadiq Khan, he's complaining about the increase in stop and search. And yet the victims of these crimes, that the mothers of these black kids that have been attacked, they're asking for more stop and search. They're saying, well, this is great. This is exactly where we need these adverts, is where these kids hang out. I mean, political correctness, it's harmed us, particularly the white community, with all the white girls that have been raped by the Muslim rape gangs, where nobody wanted to point to it because it was racism. And you got David Lammy, who's pretty much doing the same thing. He's trying to prevent there being a reduction in knife crime through this, because he thinks it's linking knife crime with blacks. I mean, has he not seen the statistics himself? Didn't he do a big study himself where he discovered that 10 times as many young blacks are in prison than whites? 10 times more likely to be in prison if you're under the age of 18 and you're black? I mean, he's done this study himself, but he thinks that these are all innocent blacks that should never have been put in prison. And he has seen the same statistics that we have. He knows that it disproportionately affects these Negroes, and yet he's got no interest in actually trying to do anything about it. He just wants to play the race card. Ms. Patel hit back and said her Labour counter was playing politics with knife crime. I will do everything in my power to stop it traumatizing communities, recruiting 20,000 officers, empowering police to stop and search, communicating the tragic consequences of carrying a knife. I will not apologize for that, she said. A spokeswoman said the scheme was being rolled out following the success of the initial pilot. She said it was done after substantial research into the best way of targeting young people and was part of a wider awareness campaign. So they've already had success with it. They've already rolled it out in an initial pilot and it was successful. And yet David Lammy and Diane Abbott, they're not actually interested in a successful pilot. They just want to claim that it's racist. Do you know what I mean there, Max? They're deliberately just putting their own people's lives on the line here to play the race card.
Yeah. I think it's just great pity, really, because from a cultural perspective, after the Second World War, there was the spread of wimpy bars across the UK. And wimpy bars were effectively burger bars, but wimpy bars were places where you went in, sat down at a table, and you had knives and forks and proper, you know, cups and cutlery. You had proper plates and things of this sort, and standards were then maintained. But that was during these early postal years, running up to the 1960s and the civil rights movement in America. And then in the era beyond that, what we've had is the other things that we've inherited as far as American culture is concerned, is McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken and all these things that have been aimed at the burgeoning black populations of America. And it's kind of created that same subculture here in the UK. And I think that one of the things that we need to do in order to restore the sort of primacy of our indigenous culture would be to have a campaign for a return to proper restaurants rather than these supposedly fast food outlets that pander to the lowest common denominator. We need to have restaurants that pander to the highest common denominator so that it has an elevating effect within society rather than the opposite thing. I think that when a government resorts to putting these kind of messages in chicken boxes, though, it's going the same way as cigarettes, isn't it? We'll soon have photographs of disemboweled young people laying on the pavement, adorning the boxes that have got sort of chicken in them, in the same way that we have on cigarette packets, you know, photographs.
I think they have actually done that. I think they have actually done that. Yeah, I think they have got pictures of people that have been stabbed, like as if this is the risk that you're running by going into these chicken shops and buying chicken. You're running the risk of being stabbed. I don't think they quite wanted to have that effect, but they've also got stories in there of people that gave up carrying a knife for becoming a DJ or whatever. I mean they've said it has actually had some success, but you can see people looking at that and just thinking, well, you know, how ridiculous, how is going out and becoming a DJ, how is that going to stop you needing to defend yourself? It's not. You're probably going to need to defend yourself all the more because you might get robbed for your records.
You could end up with a bizarre situation where you're eating chicken out of a predominantly white box that's got these pictures of people being cut to pieces on the pavement, lying in pools of blood, etc., which is going to be pretty gory, and like a slogan down the side of the chicken box saying eating chicken can seriously damage your health.
They're actually black boxes as well. Nobody's brought that up yet. The boxes are just jet black, with the hashtag knife crime on the outside of it. But, you know, I mean, at least they're trying something, and at least it does show that they are sort of admitting that it is a black problem by doing that. So, yeah, quite an entertaining news story. Anyway, anything else that you want to add before we finish here today, Max?
No, I think we've just about said it all as far as this is concerned, yes.
Okay, Well, just before we go, I'll just remind people that we do have a Bitcoin wallet. We do require donations to keep the website going. There's a you can find the Bitcoin wallet at the bottom of every article, and you can find it in the sidebar as well. Thank you very much for listening today. Thank you very much, Max, for coming on. We'll be back next Monday with more Area in Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.
listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.